This is Audible.
Defiance Audio presents Simon R. Green's Deathstalker Rebellion. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Nanette Savard, Terrence Aselford, and Colleen Delaney. Episode 2. Drowning Men. Julian Skye, Rogue Esper and Agent of the Underworld, had been handsome once, but that was before the Empire interrogators got their hands on him. They'd started with a vicious beating, not because they expected him to talk, but just to soften him up. They didn't even ask any questions. Two of them took it in turns, holding him up, while the third worked him over in brutal, efficient ways, until every part of him moaned with pain. Then they hurt him some more. They paid special attention to his face. Damage there was psychologically damaging as well. Eventually, they left, and he sat naked and alone in the interrogation cell, held upright by the thick straps holding him to the bare metal chair, waiting for them to come back and start again. One eye was swollen shut, his nose had been broken, and dried blood crusted his face. They left his mouth pretty much untouched. He was expected to be able to answer questions when they finally got around to asking him any. He'd been left alone to consider his position and worry about what was to come. And Julian Skye, who'd always thought he was a hero, was ashamed to find he couldn't stop crying. He was a young man with a young man's courage and ideals, but he'd had the courage systematically beaten out of him. All he had left now were his ideals, and they didn't seem as strong and convincing as they once had. He knew he had no one but himself to blame for his capture. Julian Skye had always been too wild for the slow and steady underground, too bold and impetuous even for the Esper terrorists of the Esper Liberation Front, the Elves. So he'd been left alone to run his own operations with his own people, attached to the underground, but not a part of it. Which was how he'd come to be in the middle of everything when the raid on Silo 9 went to hell in a hurry, and the underground had to scatter. He'd been the only one at a safe enough distance to take charge. He ran things for as long as he could, setting up safe houses and new names and passwords, until he too was compromised by the treachery of the man called Hood, and he had to run for his life. He'd got away, as he always did, leaving the security guards nothing but the echo of his mocking laughter. Truth was, he'd just been lucky, and his luck finally ran out when he made the mistake of trusting the wrong person. At least he wasn't in Silo 9 with one of Wormboy's engineered worms burrowing in his brain, controlling his thoughts. If nothing else, the underground had made a thorough job of trashing the detention center and destroying Wormboy before the raiding force was betrayed and routed. It would be years before the Empire could get it up and running again, even if they could create another artificial Esper like Wormboy to be their perfect jailer again. And the worms wouldn't work without him. Which was why Skye was being held in a detention cell, mentally neutered by an S-blocker. There was the sudden sound of electronic locks disengaging, and the sealed door swung slowly open. Julian would have cringed away, but even that was denied to him. His chief interrogator strode in, a tall, slender man dressed all in white, so the bloodstains would show up dramatically. So much of pain is in the mind.
"You have a visitor, Julian. I've adjusted the spinal block so you can talk freely. Make the most of your time together. When you've finished, it will be my turn to talk to you."
The interrogator left while Julian tried to get his thoughts in order. Who the hell could it be that the mind techs would allow the visit to a man they were in the middle of softening up? He heard footsteps approaching and braced himself as best he could. And then, Bibi Chojiro stepped through the door.
Chapel soap.
Julian thought his heart would stop. She looked beautiful, as always. A petite little doll of a woman, with long dark hair and sharp oriental features. She wore a bright scarlet kimono to match her lips and looked at him steadily with dark, lustrous eyes. She stopped before him, and the door swung shut behind her. Julian looked at her and felt the horror rise in him again. They knew about Bibi. If they hurt her, he thought he'd go out of his mind just at the thought. She stepped forward, moving even here with the perfect grace of all her clan, and produced a small metal box from inside her sleeve. She pressed the single stud on the top, and the spinal block released the rest of its hold on him. He slumped forward, held up only by the restraining straps. His fingers spasmed helplessly. She put away the metal box and produced a silk handkerchief to wipe some of the blood and tears from his face. Her touch was very gentle.
My poor Julian, what have they done to you? You used to be so strong, so sure. Now they've broken your wings and you'll never fly again.
Bibi.
He forced his mouth to obey him.
Have they hurt you? What?
Don't try to speak. Just listen. I can't stay long. I want you to tell them everything, Julian. I want you to tell them everything you know. It's for the best, really. You know they'll get it out of you anyway. They always do. Only what will be left of you then won't even know who I am. If you cooperate, they'll let you go eventually, and then we can be together again, just like we were before. You would like that, wouldn't you, Julian?
He looked at her and didn't say a word. He'd known her less than a year. She'd been his younger brother's lover originally. Oryx Sky had tried to get a position in Clan Chojiro so that he could be with her. To impress the clan, he fought the masked gladiator in the arena. The gladiator killed him. Oryx never stood a chance against that legendary butcher of men. Julian had told him that, but Oryx wouldn't listen, and Julian had watched in silence as they dragged his brother's body away across the bloody sands. Julian would have avenged Oryx if he could, but he at least had the sense to know he couldn't beat the masked gladiator in a fair or unfair fight. So he put it behind him, as just another evil episode in an evil empire, and went to see Bibi Chojiro to comfort and console her over Oryx's death. They talked about Oryx all through the evening and on into the night, and at the end, she cried in his arms. They met again, and fell in love. Julian felt guilty about that for a while, but Bibi talked him out of it. She made him see that Oryx would have been glad for both of them. He cried in her arms then, finally saying goodbye to his brother. After that, Julian and Bibi were together as often as they could be. It wasn't very often. It was vital that the clan Chojiro didn't find out. They were very strict and wouldn't have approved at all. And Julian had his obligations to the underground. It was a long time before he told her about that. She was surprised at first, but then she hugged him and kissed him and told him he'd done the right thing in telling her. It wasn't long after that they came for him. Not long at all. Julian Sky looked at his love, kneeling before him, and knew for the first time who it was that had betrayed him.
I thought you loved me. How could you do it?
It wasn't difficult, darling. My duty has always been to my clan, first and foremost. Oryx knew that. That's why he died, trying to be a part of Clan Chojiro. You never did ask me what my real name is, what the BB stands for.
You told me not to.
Yes. And you always did what you were told. But the fact that I kept something as basic as that from you should have told you something. Bibi isn't my name, darling. It's my designation. I'm from Blue Block.
The words hit Julian like blows. He'd heard of Blue Block, but only in whispers. Blue Block was the company of lords' deepest secret, a hidden private army of lesser cousins to be the family's final defense against the Empress and her people. Every family provided a number of candidates, willing or unwilling, and sent them to Blue Block, where they were trained and conditioned to be totally loyal to their clans, even to the death. They were everywhere, unknown and unsuspected, programmed to get as close as possible to people who mattered. In the last resort, they would be the Lord's last poisoned weapon to throw at Lionstone, or anyone else who tried to take away their power and position. Or so it was said. Blue Block was only a whisper, less than a rumor. Lionstone didn't take it seriously. If she had, she wouldn't have rested until every graduate of Blue Block had been tracked down and executed. She would never have allowed such a threat to her power to exist. B.B. Chojiro, Blue Block, bound to her clan beyond hope or honor, life or death.
Our love meant nothing to you, did it?
There's no room in my life for what you think of as love. I was very fond of you. I still am. That's why I want you to tell the interrogators what they want to know and get it over with. The interrogator's one of us. He's Blue Block, too. Once he's got everything out of you, he'll put you back together as much as he can, and you can come back to me. You can be part of Clan Chojiro, just like your brother wanted. You'll have to go through Blue Block, of course, but it's really not so bad. And then you won't care anything about who you used to be or what you used to be.
If I talk, hundreds will die. Thousands will be endangered. The underground would have to scatter again. It might never recover. I can't do that. I won't.
You will. You know you will. Talk to the interrogator, darling. Do it for me.
Do it for you?
Julian would have laughed, but his throat was too dry.
Who are you? I don't know your real name. I don't know the real you. I loved you, you bitch. I would have done anything for you. Even die for you. Now, just looking at you makes me feel sick.
Don't be like that, Julian. We had some good times together, just the two of us. Remember flying out over the Ravenscar Mountains and chasing each other on gravity sleds in and out of the great waterfalls as they came thundering down? Remember watching the double stars burning brightly over the Tannhauser Gate? Remember us dancing around a fire on the dust plains of memory, dancing and singing as though the night would never end? Those were real times, Julian. Times we shared. We could share them again. We could still have a life together. It's up to you. You'll forget all about the underground with me.
Baby, will you do something for me?
Of course, darling. Would you like some water?
No. Just lean closer.
Bibi Chojiro smiled and brought her face in close to his. He could smell her familiar perfume. She pursed her mouth for a kiss. And Julian called up all the strength he had left and head-butted her in the face. He couldn't get much force behind it, but the impact was enough to knock her right back on her ass. Shock and surprise filled her face, and then pain as she brought her hands up to her nose. Blood streamed from her nostrils. Julian chuckled harshly, even though it hurt his throat. Bibi blinked at him uncertainly over her hands, and then rose jerkily to her feet. She wiped at her nose with a silken scarlet arm, but just succeeded in smearing more blood across her face. She gave up on it and drew herself up, perfectly composed, ignoring the blood. She smiled at him in a brittle, satisfied way.
Thank you, Julian. I was beginning to feel a little sorry for you, for what you're about to undergo. You've helped remind me why I turned you in. You're scum, the lowest of the low. So far beneath the families, we can't even see you from where we are. And to think I nearly made you one of us. Talk about the Blue Block all you like. Only the interrogator will hear you. And he will see it doesn't go any further, even if he has to edit the security tapes. Think of me while he's working on you. I'll be thinking of you.
She rapped imperiously on the door, and it swung open. Bibi Chojiro blew Julian a kiss and strode out of the cell, every inch the perfect little aristocrat. Julian seethed inwardly against the restraining straps, but they held him securely. He loved her so much. But all he could think of now was his hands around her perfect throat, her mocking smile, replaced by a scream of terror. He laughed suddenly, a harsh, brutal sound of the darkest humor. And the interrogator paused in the doorway of the cell, as though suddenly aware he was about to enter a small, enclosed space with a dangerous animal. But the moment passed, and the interrogator strode in, smiling avuncularly at his prospective victim. He shut the door firmly behind him, so that Julian's screams wouldn't bother anyone, walking down the corridor outside. Lionstone 14, that most revered and feared empress of 1,000 worlds and more, was holding court once again, and everyone that mattered, or thought they might, made haste to attend her. The court itself was an arctic waste, this time, as real as holographic projections, strategically placed props, and temperature controls could make it. The Empress redressed her court constantly, to reflect her whims and changing moods, or just to give her courtiers a bad time. Veteran court attendees claimed to be able to divine much of Lionstone's mood from studying each new court, but even when the news was bad, people went anyway. You had to if you wanted your voice to be heard. Besides, if you stayed away too often, Lionstone might take that as an insult, and the people she sent to drag you there to hear her displeasure would not be polite about it. It was a long way down to the court. People made jokes about descending into hell, but not very loudly. Captain Silence, Investigator Frost, and Security Officer Stelmach stood together in the midst of a great crowd of courtiers, staring out over a bleak, arctic waste that stretched off into the distance for as far as the eye could see. The snow was a good foot deep on the ground, and more fell in heavy wet flakes from the brooding gray sky above. A thin mist pearled the air, thickening briefly here and there into impenetrable walls. It was bitter cold, searing exposed flesh and the lungs of those who breathed too deeply, and Silence turned up the heating elements in his uniform another notch. Frost didn't bother. It took more than mere cold to discommode an investigator. She'd been trained to withstand far worse. Stelmach already had his heating elements running on full, but shivered anyway. He wasn't looking forward to meeting the Empress. The gathered courtiers murmured among themselves for a while, and then some brave soul stepped forward, and everyone else trudged through the snow after him. Few had come prepared for Arctic conditions, and the bright flashing silks of current fashion did little to protect their wearers. A few grumbled and blasphemed under their breath, but most just toughed it out. You never knew who might be listening. The snow fell and the mists thickened, and still the Arctic scene stretched out before them. Silence frowned. The courtroom couldn't be that large. Perhaps they were being subtly influenced to walk in circles. He looked up sharply as an agitated murmur began again among the courtiers. The crowd lurched to a halt, those on the edges looking quickly about them. Nothing moved in the mists. Silence looked at Frost, who was listening carefully. She gestured for him to lean close so that she could murmur in his ear.
There's something moving under the snow, Captain. It's large and alive. I can feel the vibrations and I can hear the sound it makes as it moves.
A snow snake, perhaps. They have those on Loki. Some of the big ones run to 20 feet long.
Oh, no. Not snakes. I really don't like snakes.
Don't worry. If it annoys the investigator, she'll tie it in a square knot and throw it away. Right, Frost?
Damn right.
And that was when a set of jaws 10 feet wide opened up beneath the courtier's feet, gulped him down, and disappeared back into the concealing snow. His friends and family shouted in alarm and fell to their knees to dig at the snow with their bare hands, but there was no trace left of whatever had taken him. They looked at each other helplessly. And far away in the snow and mists came the light tinkling of laughter. The Empress was amused. There was nothing to be done. Man proposes, and the Empress disposes. And that was just the way it was in the Empire these days. Silence said nothing, but his face was set and grim. The snow surged up suddenly at the crowd's edge as the snow creature's blunt head broke the surface. People scattered with shouts and shrieks. The great mouth opened and spat out the courtier it had taken. The creature's head dropped back into the snow and disappeared. The courtier sailed through the air and hit the packed snow hard. But his plaintive groan showed that at least he was still alive. His friends clustered around him, checked that he was basically undamaged, and got him on his feet again. Linestone laughed again, and everyone who liked their head where it was laughed along with her. Even the courtier, who'd briefly seen the inside of something much larger than he was, managed a shaky laugh, though he was probably just glad to be alive. Frost looked at Silence.
Big snake.
Stelmach nodded rapidly, his eyes very large. The courtiers trudged on again, driving their legs through the deep snow. It actually seemed to be getting colder, if that was possible. The courtiers had packed close together for support and shared body warmth, but they still kept clear of Silence, Frost, and Stelmach. They knew pariahs when they saw them. Everyone agreed it had been a dark day for the Empire in general, and the court in particular, when the Empress decided she had a sense of humor. Strange shapes loomed up out of the mists ahead, huge shards of solid ice thrusting up out of the snow, like the only part of the iceberg you ever see. The ice structures formed a rough semicircle, inviting the courtiers in. And there at the far end stood the Iron Throne, set up high on a great block of ice. And on that ancient chair of black iron, studded with jade, sat the Empress Lionstone 14, calmly watching their stumbling approach. She was wrapped in layers of thick furs, like some ancient tribal leader, her pale face as cold and clear as the legendary Ice Queen, who stole men's souls by sliding shards of ice into their eyes and hearts. She had a long, sharp-planed face, with a wide slash of a mouth and brilliant blue eyes, colder than any ice could ever be. She was beautiful, but that, too, was a cold kind of beauty, like the tall diamond crown on her head. The Empress, the worshipped and adored, whose whims were law, at whose merest word men died and worlds burned. Also known as the Iron Bitch. She sat at ease on the Iron Throne, watching with a sardonic smile as the courtiers drew up before her, bowed their heads, and then held themselves in that humble and uncomfortable position while they waited for the word from the Empress that would release them. On bad days, she'd been known to keep them there for ages, till sweat dropped off their faces and their backs screamed for release. Today, she gave them permission to straighten up after only a few seconds, suggesting either she was in a good mood after all, or she was really looking forward to something yet to come. The courtiers practiced looking polite and respectful, and extremely loyal, as the Empress's smile wandered over them. They also kept a respectful distance, not just because of the 20 armed guards spread out behind the throne, but also because of Lionstone's maids-in-waiting, who crouched snarling silently at her feet. There were 10 of them, each more dangerous than any armed man. They wore no clothes, but they didn't feel the cold. They didn't feel anything unless the Empress permitted it. Mind techs had stirred their sticky fingers in the maid's brains until nothing remained there but unquestioning obedience to the Empress. They would die to protect her, or kill as required. They were cunning, deadly fighters with hidden, implanted weaponry. They were silent because they had no tongues, and they perceived the world only through grafted cybernetic senses. But for once, not even they were enough to hold the courtier's gaze. Beside the throne, standing a little to one side in the swirling snow, huge and awful, stood a yoked Grendel alien. The Grendel alien stood 9 feet tall in spiked crimson silicon armor that was somehow a part of it. It had vicious fangs and claws and was roughly humanoid in shape, but its large, heart-shaped face had nothing even remotely like a human expression. More than ever, Silence wished he had his weapons with him, or at least some idea which way the exit was. The courtiers studied the Grendel silently and were not happy. They understood the need for increased security at court after previous attacks by both aliens and elves, but a personal Grendel on a leash was going a bit far, even for Lionstone. This had gone beyond safety or style, and headed firmly in the direction of overkill. Possibly literally. Those at the front of the crowd were seized with a sudden polite wish for others to take up their privileged vantage point, and attempted to fade back into the crowd. The rank behind them were having none of this, and resisted strongly. If the yoke should fail, everyone knew better than to think the armed guards would try to protect them. That wasn't what they were there for. The courtiers somehow managed to stir rebelliously in complete silence. Frost leaned in close beside Stalmach, who jumped slightly. Frost didn't smile.
I thought you said you were the only one with a yoked Grendel, and that one was destroyed on Hayden. So what's this doing here?
Apparently, research has moved on in my absence.
Stalmach tried to talk without moving his lips, so as to avoid drawing attention to himself. Frost frowned heavily.
Just how dependable is that yoke?
Depends on what you mean by dependable. Unless they've made some major breakthrough, which I strongly doubt, the yoke is strictly on-off. Once the Grendel's been unleashed, it will kill anything it sees. The best you can hope to do is make sure it's aimed in the right direction. If that yoke follows the processes my people set up, it should do its job, but I wouldn't like to bet my life on it.
We are betting our lives on it.
I know.
Silence looked about him, not bothering to hide his interest. He had no doubt there were more armed guards around that he couldn't see, probably hidden behind concealing holograms, plus any number of S-blockers to keep out Esper terrorists, and a whole set of other protections he probably wouldn't even recognize. The Empress was said to have spent more than one fortune making her courtroom as secure as was humanly and inhumanly possible. It wasn't just paranoia. There were a lot of people who would like to see Lionstone dead, who'd dance at her funeral and piss on her grave. Quite a lot of them could be found among the courtiers, which was why they were only admitted unarmed after a complete body scan. And despite their justified nervousness, a great many of the courtiers were determined to be heard. For the first time in years, they were pretty sure they had a chance to force power out of Lionstone's hands and into theirs. They had something that, if properly handled, might just drive a wedge between the Empress and the military that supported her. The rebels' triumphant trashing on the Tax and Tithe headquarters, along with their breaking open of the planet's defenses, had made the military's position very vulnerable, politically speaking. The sudden alien attack had only emphasized this. If Lionstone and her military couldn't protect her own planet from a single alien ship and a handful of rebels, she and they were in no position to try and dictate terms to the Company of Lords and the members of Parliament, whose monies helped to pay for everything. The bottom line of which was, if they were going to pay higher taxes for the Empire's security, they wanted more of a say in how that money was to be spent. And preferably before the tax records could be worked out again and the new rates decided. Not being blind to all this, the military had taken steps to establish a strong presence among the courtiers, to protect Lionstone against all threats, even those that might come from the court itself. The Church of Christ the Warrior had its own strong presence, with ranks of armored acolytes standing alongside the military and studiously ignoring them. They had pale faces and shaved heads and the unblinking glare of the true fanatic. They were warrior priests, raised in a hot and bloody faith since childhood, and they bowed to the Empress only when circumstances forced them to it. There were other religions in the Empire, but mostly they kept their heads down and tried to avoid being noticed.